Welcome. It's wonderful to see your faces, to be able to sit together. This week's Torah reading, Parsha Tetzaveh, continues with God's instructions to Moses on how to create space in this material world for connection with the unknowable, with the great mystery and miracle of life as it emerges moment to moment. Last week we read in Parshat Truma God's instructions to Moses, Ve'asuli mikdash v'shechanti b'toham, let them, the Israelites, make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Or, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and Rabbi Shefa Gold and others point out, we can read this is that I may dwell within them, within each of them. In response to the instructions, people bring offerings of gold, silver, copper, fabrics of all colors, gems, an outpouring of material offerings, and an outpouring of collaborative labor. This week, we read about all the implements of ritual practice, the details of the elaborate robes, instruction for ordination of the priest, for offering, and for the construction and care of the altar. It's important to recognize that the words do not say, let them build me a sanctuary that I may dwell within it, bitochu. The sanctuary is not a building for God to actually live in, because of course God can't be contained in the confines of a building. Rather, the building is a space for human encounter with the truth of the reality we live in. In that way, we can see it as similar to a meditation hall or a metaphor, as we talked about last week, for the structure of the human body through which within which we experience from time to time a sense of connection with something greater than ourselves. So today I'd like to wonder along with you, how do these material objects and structures, the silver, gold, cloth, and gems for the building and the priestly clothes and all the ornaments and implements in the temple, create space for awareness? Space for the great truth of the reality in which we live, a truth that has no material presence in a way, and is entirely our material presence. How do the same colors that adorn the temple, that are sewn into the cloth to make robes, create a space, a sacred space for the body to inhabit during the temple service? These questions are inspired by two of our teachers, Norman Fisher and Shefa Gold, who've written and spoken about the meaning of taking refuge in our practice, our rituals, our sacred spaces. In her book, Torah Journeys, Rabbi Gold reminds us that God says to us, make for me a holy place that I may dwell inside you. It is possible, she writes, to stay connected with me at all times, even as you engage in the life of the world. She goes on, when we make a place for God to dwell in our lives, then we will never again be trapped in the illusion of separateness. So let's remember to go back to this line about the illusion of separateness, as it comes up in Norman Fisher's teachings as well. Rabbi Gold continues, God will be available and accessible to us in the innermost chamber of our heart and in the inner dimension of all creation. Spiritual practice is about making our lives into a mishkan, a dwelling place for the divine, she writes. It's a beautiful idea and intention, but how can we do it? And how can we actually experience it or feel it? So Ketsu Norman Fisher shares his Zen and Jewish meditation teachings on the website of the Everyday Zen Virtual Sangha. It's open to all of us. And this month, as part of a Zen practice period, the group is studying the writings of Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, on living by vow. Zen practitioners take on many vows as part of practice. Does this sound familiar? Many mitzvot. Last week, Norman's talk was about what it meant to take refuge in the practice. And when I listened to his recorded talk, I was struck that the very same week in the Jewish world, we were reading the Torah portion about building the sanctuary and how sanctuary has come to mean a place of refuge. Then this week, Norman went into great detail about the history and ritual and practice surrounding the sewing and wearing of robes for Zen priests and practitioners. And this week in the Jewish world, we read in great detail about the elaborate construction of the priestly robes. So I'll share some of Norman's teachings. Norman began his talk last week, as he has in every week recently, reflecting on the chaos, destruction, and dread that has become part of our daily news and daily reality since January 20th, 2025. And in the context of this destruction, he asks, where do we find refuge in something reliable? What is reliable and enduring? When we are children, we rely on our parents, and ultimately, we discover that they are imperfect and consistent, subject to aging, illness, and death. In other words, we can't rely on them forever. Maybe we find a partner or a group of friends who give us great comfort and support until they too experience their impermanence, as do all humans, the impermanent nature of their reliability. Of course, our jobs, our work also cannot promise enduring, reliable refuge. What can we rely on? Norman explains that the Japanese word for refuge is kiei, which stands for to return to submit to rely on. In Sanskrit, the word sadhana means refuge or protection. And in Latin, refuge comes from the verb to fly back, like a bird flying back to its nest, flying home. We think of ourselves, our communities, our friends, our commitments, all of these things that we rely on. We recognize now that we are all subject to change or loss or attack. All the physical and material things we rely on are subject to change and loss. So then what is reliable within this material world? To find the one reliable refuge, he says, we have to give up what we have unconsciously and unsuccessfully been taking refuge in, ourself. The only thing, he says, that is ultimate reliable is the truth. It is right here, within and yet beyond what we know, the truth of reality as it emerges in each moment. It's not a something, not the Buddhist church or teachings. It's the profound recognition that we have to let go of ourself. And then we can truly enjoy our partners, our friends, our communities, the work we do. Because we will have taken refuge in what underlies all of it, reality. It is having a deep and awesome respect for reality itself, he says. And then, he says, this is the same as fear of God in the Abrahamic traditions, not fear of a punishment, but a deep and awesome respect for reality, for being itself, Then, he says, when things fall apart, we understand that this is natural and that there is a fundamental truth of reality, just as it is that we are part of and that is part of us. So we're fortunate that our teacher, Rabbi Jeff Roth, has given us a way of understanding the unpronounceable name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as what he's called the truth of reality unfolding, the unfolding of being. And he explains this in part, he has many ways of describing this, but one important note is that when Moses asks Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, who should I say sent me? This is at the burning bush. The response that Moses hears is, Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I will be what I will be. I am the unfolding of being in each moment. This is a welcome teaching for those of us who feel awkward or put on the spot when someone says, well, do you believe in God? What is God? We now have some words to capture the indescribable experience that we sometimes feel in practice that we can let go into the fundamental truth of reality unfolding. And just this morning, as we chanted, Ve'anachnu nivarach yah me'ata ve'ad olam, from now until forever, ad olam, is captured in that sense, not that we're going to go on singing this song forever, but that we are praising something that we experience as eternal. And Rabbi Sheffa Gold also reflects on seeking something enduring in the world of change. She reflects, when I was a child attending synagogue, I was fascinated by the Ner Tamid, the eternal light that hung above the ark. Everything changes, everyone dies, yet there was a light that would shine on regardless of circumstances. And I'm sure she doesn't mean the little tiny light bulb that was there. She's aware, even as a child. No matter what storms of doubt I suffered, this small light was constant. I took refuge in this light and found it within me. That's the finding it within. Tetzaveh begins by blessing us with the light of eternity. We learn that this light, which Sheffa Gold says, is consciousness itself, requires our daily attention. We stoke the fires of our eternal light and internal light with our practice. Tetzaveh also describes the priestly robes, the breastplate with the gems that seem to have divining powers, and the crown. The Mishkan is a sanctuary that, unlike a temple, can be moved through the wilderness on the journey. We can carry it around, and it contains an empty space for connection with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So if a portable tabernacle creates a more accessible means of connecting with God than a building, then the sacred robes or a talis are that much more portable, as we can carry them anywhere and inhabit their sacred space anywhere. Rabbi Gold points out that the sacred garments are made with materials of the same color as the Mishkan, creating a space that we inhabit with our bodies. So in this week's Everyday Zen Talk, Norman went into elaborate detail about the robes of the Zen priests. In Zen practice, everyone sews their own sacred garments, whether it's a small vest or a large robe, it is cut and put together and stitched by the person who wears the robe. You don't just pick it up at the store. And here are some things that Norman taught about the sacred garments. There is a ritual for putting on the robes. You say a blessing when you put the robes on at the beginning of the service. That's the final robe that you put on is done at the very beginning of the service in the sanctuary. You say a blessing, okay, and you take special care of the robes. When you pack them, you put them on top without putting other clothes on top of them. You always wear it to Dharma events. You never wear it in the bathroom. Is this beginning to sound familiar? Whether it is the Mishkan, the temple, the robes, the talis with the tzitzit, all are reminders that there is a space within us where we can be free to be simply alive and present, free from the limiting concepts of self, free of craving for things to be different than they are, free to simply be alive. So after reviewing all these reflections on taking refuge and letting go of self, I felt, I'm not quite sure this captures what it feels like, all these words. So happily, one of the assignments for my wise aging group this week, the assignment for this week was reviewing chapter 9 of Frank Ostasevsky's book, The Five Invitations, which is what the dying have to teach us about living. And Frank offers a vivid example in the form of a story about a dying man who thought of himself as a fallen Catholic. So in our multi-theological, multi-ethnic journey, I find that this story helps us make the theoretical teachings of Zen and Jewish practice very palpable and real. Ostasevsky quotes, and I'm quoting from his book, "Matt was a gay man and a longtime Buddhist practitioner who was hospitalized with pneumonia related to his HIV diagnosis." This was years ago. "He was writhing in bed, crying out, overcome by anxiety, fearing eternal damnation and shame at how he had lived his life. Matthew had been raised as a fundamentalist in a fundamentalist Christian family. The commandments of a punishing God had literally been beaten into him by his father. Now, believing he was close to death, he was sure that God would condemn him for eternity to hell. Attempting to soothe his suffering and agitation, Frank created an altar at his bedside. Matthew's beloved Buddha statue and a Tibetan painting that's a sacred practice for healing were there. When that failed to calm him, Frank held his hand, massaged his feet, played his favorite chanting music. Still no change. A sedative was ordered and it didn't work. At 2 a.m, exhausted, Frank decided he needed sleep. He drove home feeling ineffective and powerless. For some reason, on the way home, he thought of his first Holy Communion as a child, when the innocent child is welcomed into the loving lap of God. The word communion, of course, means connection with God. When he got home, he searched through his storage closet to find his memory box, a small connection of mementos. There he located a 5-inch plastic figurine of Jesus surrounded by lambs and little children. Instead of going to bed, he drove right back to the hospital. He replaced the Buddha statue with a small plastic Jesus. As he was smoothing down the altar cloth, a cleaning woman named Dina came into the room and spotted the figurine. Setting her mop to one side, she said with great enthusiasm, "Merciful Jesus, when his kingdom is with us, everything is all right." At once, Matthew's eyes locked onto Dina. An angelic smile spread across his face as he pivoted toward the altar to gaze at the plastic Jesus statue, and then back in Dina's direction. His entire body relaxed. In that moment, the punishing God of Matthew's childhood was transformed into the merciful God he also knew and loved. The one who adored the God who adored all children and a kind, forgiving, all-accepting, and benevolent God. Dina's faith in God's love was so secure that it lent Matthew the strength he needed to defeat the punishing God he had carried with him from his youth, Frank writes. He had found refuge, returning to a deep and early experience of a loving home. When Frank eventually returned that afternoon, Matthew was sitting up in bed, smiling and eating a bowl of Jell-O. So we'll take a few moments of silence before we have our discussion.